and welcome to Literary Lunch, a light lunch for your literary appetite. I'm Beth, and this is my co-host, V. Today, we're going to be talking about Beach Boy by Otessa Moshfegh.
Hey, munchies! You know, I was the photographer at Beth's wedding.
Where are you going with this? Why are we talking about my wedding? I feel like we're talking about my wedding and my honeymoon a lot, and I just feel like one of those obnoxious newlyweds who's
saying, other than my amazing photography skills, hire me for all your needs, guys. I know how to click a camera button. I appreciate a good portrait. A well-executed scene, if you will.
For me, this story is like a competently executed portrait of like the Dean of Libraries from 1967. Yeah, okay, it's got the skill. Where's the artistry?
I love anticlimactic stories when the character could change but doesn't. It's so cynical. I love it.
See, if I wanted that, I would go on Twitter and look up the latest controversial hashtag about women or minorities. I could find so many people like that on there.
I didn't say I was in love with the story, but I respect a respectable portrait and plus points for your tongue-in-cheek.
Let's just do the synopsis. This awful boring man and his awful boring wife have just come back from their vacation and are having dinner with friends. Wow, remember vacations? Remember dining out? Remember friends?
Focus.
Right, sorry. So, they talk about their vacation, spouting off weird racist hot takes right and left, and then they go home to watch a movie. The wife dies sitting on the couch, the husband comes back in and doesn't realize it, so he puts on the movie and falls asleep on the couch next to her slowly cooling body.
After her funeral, he's called to pick up some pictures of hers from their vacation. He does, and at the very bottom of the stack, he discovers a picture that his wife took up close of one of the male prostitutes on the island known as the Beach Boys. He becomes indignant that his wife kept him on such a tight leash all his life, only to have apparently hired a Beach Boy on their vacation. He goes back to the island, gets drunk, and decides to go swimming in the ocean. Of course, he almost drowns, but he's saved by one of the Beach Boys. This is his big chance at redemption, but he still fails to see the Beach Boy as a human being. Now for the lightning round review.
So, I actually picked another story, but V rejected that on account of it being too bland.
So?
This was literally the blandest thing.
Hey, at least this has personality.
Yeah, like the personality of an angsty, middle-aged, rich white man.
That's the point.
I still prefer the raisin toast of the bunkie to this.
That was not raisin toast. That was an actual piece of bread, and not the fresh-baked French kind.
Regardless, I'd rather snack on a piece of bread than, like, celery dipped in oatmeal. Sure, it's unexpected, but it's also completely unappealing.
Spice up your life, Beth. You're on your honeymoon.
Not every meal has to be spicy, and we are not talking about my honeymoon and spice in the same sentence.
Okay, we're doing the discussion. We disagree too much to make coherent jokes about this. Discussion time.
Agreed. Alright, so I think one of the core things that made us approach the story from such different angles is what V and what I think makes a good or an enjoyable story. Me, personally, I don't really like stories that are literary for the sake of it, without actually saying anything but, wow, doesn't this guy suck?
I actually don't mind if the plot isn't crazy, if it is artfully executed, thoughtful, vivid, and complicated. The plot doesn't have to be the driving force if it's well written. So I found Otessa Moshfegh through her novel My Year of Rest and Relaxation, which I absolutely loved. And it had a similar sort of ironic caricaturization of the characters into parodies of themselves. But these caricatures could then think and talk and behave in ways that a character that would need to be 100% imperfectly realistic would not be able to behave. So, like, the protagonist of this story is totally a trash human being, but that's okay because he's a painting of a trash human.
Right. But I think, so what I gather is that this sort of self-parody or parody of character for you sort of operates in the same way that genre fiction does for me, where because it's got that element of unrealism or even surrealism or something like that, it makes it easier to come at things from a different angle, a new perspective.
This is totally that rich white asshole that exists, you know? This is like that guy. And it's like, it's unapologetically that guy. It's not a redeeming human version of that guy, you know?
I think that's why it was so hard for me, because I see that guy so much in everyday life. And I just am like, not really in the mood to see him in my stories. But again, that's a matter of personal taste.
That guy makes the following observation. Very literary. If he could have it his way, nobody would ever say anything again. The entire world would go silent. Even the clocks wouldn't tick. All that mattered would be the beating of hearts, the widening and narrowing of pupils, the whirling of ties and loose strands of hair in the wind. Nothing voluntary, nothing false. It's so literary, am I right?
Yeah. It sure is literary. Actually, no, I really do like that sentence. I think it's pretty cool. What we want to talk about next is sort of how this story explores racism or bigotry or fetishization. I didn't really think it examined those issues in a thought-provoking way. Or maybe if it did, I wasn't like, I didn't have my subtlety sensors tuned up high enough to really, for it to really make an impact on me.
I don't think it's supposed to be subtle. I like how overt it is. It's just these super rich, bigoted New Yorkers. There's a passage where Marcia says, in reference to the Beach Boys, "You're not supposed to acknowledge them at all. You don't even look them in the eye. If you do, they'll never leave you alone. The Beach Boys, the male prostitutes, I mean. It's sad," she added. "Tragic, and really one wonders how anybody can starve in a place like that. There was food everywhere, fruit on every tree. I just don't understand it. And the city was rife with garbage, rife," she proclaimed. It's not even subtle, and I kind of love how unapologetically horrible the characters are, because I hate them, and that's the point. Often, racism and dehumanization are so overt. And yes, there's many ways in which those things manifest subtly, but there's so many times that those things are so overt.
Yeah, there is that. Especially when a rich white couple is just talking, quote unquote, amongst friends, like amongst people of their class and their ethnicity and things like that. People can really let the mask slip in those situations. So yeah, I get what you're saying there.
And there's also this, like, perception of people from external cultures as being, and I'm going to say this word in the quote, primitive.
Yep. Our favorite word. Our favorite vocabulary word.
In reference to human beings. Yep. So, the quote goes, "He wasn't suffering from a grave illness. He wasn't starving. He wasn't being exploited or enslaved." Interjection, "But if you were, this would be a different conversation." Anyway, but gazing out the window of the tour bus on the island, he had felt envious of the locals, of their ability to do whatever was in their nature. His own struggles seemed like petty complications, meaningless snags in the dull itinerary that was his life. Why couldn't he live by instinct and appetite? Be primitive, be free. "I should be happy," he told himself. "Marcia is." Even the beggars tapping at car windows, begging for pennies, were smiling. "Hello, nice people," the Beach Boys had said. This xenophobic perception of people from different cultures as being lesser beings and having lesser problems and therefore having a simpler, happier life.
Yeah, I think the more we talk about this, the more your point of view is starting to grow on me, because now I'm just like, it is pretty patently ridiculous that this man is looking at people who are starving, begging in really shitty situations, and he's like, "Oh, they're smiling when they're begging from me, so I guess they must be happy," and not just like, you know, doing basically the customer service thing of, you know, smiling so you get a bigger tip.
Yeah, and just like viewing their problems as somehow being less than his.
Well, I think he was putting his own problems down in relation to theirs, but in a really ignorant way. He's just assuming all these things about their lives from kind of what he's, I guess, read in the New York Times or whatever, and he has this really surface level view of what their lives are like. And somehow he sees them as being both, like, much more difficult, but also a lot more fun. Like, oh man, these guys don't have to go to a stinky job every day. They can just stand around on the beach and beg for food. Man, I wish I could be so primitive and free.
It's very yikes. And then the second topic we wanted to cover is the idea of how one behaves and approaches grieving and mourning.
So this is actually a pretty, I want to say, relevant topic to me right now, because I lost both my mother and my grandfather this past year. His mourning process, and more than that, like, the way he reacts so judgmentally to one picture he found of hers was so alien to me. It just seems like he found this tiny shred of evidence that his dead wife was a horrible person, and it's like he secretly hated her their entire lives together, and now he gets to just revel in that feeling of hatred that was tamped down all those years. It's this weird sense of, like, grief, but underneath that is this boiling satisfaction and sense of vindication, almost.
John sometimes felt as if he were just a strange appendage to his wife. He thought of all the wishbone wishes he'd wasted on her petty desires. Good seats at the movies, a trip to Vermont to see foliage, a sale on cashmere sweaters or towels. And secretly, all along, she'd been a whore, he thought, a deviant, a pervert, cruising with prostitutes right under his nose. Meanwhile, she'd shushed him every time he'd said anything remotely off-color, as if anyone were paying attention, as if it even mattered. John tore at the hole he'd made in the plastic bag, crawled all over the sand on his knees, felt for the water, and dumped the ashes out.
I don't know, this is kind of a meme, but, like, why are you married to someone you hate?
The story is trying to make a point about him being living this life of, like, repressed conformity versus having this wild moment of freedom where he can do what he wants.
And as it turns out, what he wants to do is drink himself silly and almost drown.
He says in a quote, "His plan was to find the boy from Marcia's photo and do whatever she had done with him off in the dunes at night while he was sleeping. That would be revenge enough to set his heart at ease," he thought. It would be the strange thing that gave his life some meaning at last. It would be his life's one adventure.
First of all, ew. That is a person, not a sex object. And second of all, what a sad little life. I mean, I know that's the point, but also, like, can you imagine having enough money to just, like, go on vacation to this nice island and then you're still so miserable?
I think that's the point of the story. I like the story a lot. I think it's very well written, and it does give the message that it is built to give. I mean, you hate the characters, but that's why I love the story.
I have to say, I don't love it. I would probably not choose to read it on my own, but having talked about it more, I feel as if I understand it more, and I can see more of the author's intent and how well she did what she intended with this. And I think, you know, like you said, it's definitely very impressive that she could.
My favorite part of the story was actually the end, because John says, the quote, "You saved me." As he reached a hand out to grip the boy's ankle, his fingers trembled. Some kind of a force field seemed to surround the boy. He couldn't be touched. When John held his palm over the boy's foot, he could feel heat rising up. The boy took a step away. Perhaps he isn't even real, John thought, but there he was. "Come here," John demanded. "I need to ask you something." He got onto his hands and knees, tried to stand, but he was too exhausted. He was drunk. He collapsed onto the sand. The boy stood and stared for a while, then yawned and turned and walked away. It was clear to him and to the other beach boys watching from their perch in the dunes that the old man wasn't carrying any money. So there's this surreal moment where this boy saves his life and he tells his friends that the storm, quote, "barely made a dent, shut everything down. You know these poor countries, there's no infrastructure. Every time you intervene and make some order, the people are so superstitious, it would take 100 years with all their spells and blessings." So it's like, yes, this big moment to see the Beach Boy as a human being who steps in to save his life, but he just misses it.
The big area where we differ is on unlikable characters. I don't really see why you would want to read a portrait of a pretentious, sad, rich, middle-aged white man, no matter how well done it is.
And I think this is a great portrait of a pretentious, sad, rich, middle-aged white man, and I think that makes it worth reading.
I originally was going to give the story a 2.5, but I think I'm going to bump it up to a 3, because even though it's not to my taste, it is well-crafted.
I would give the story a 4.
So I guess since we gotta average that, it's going to be a 3.5 out of 5.
That's it for today.
Follow us on Twitter at LitLunchCast, email us at litlunchpodcast@gmail.com, or find us on our website, literarylunchpodcast.wordpress.com.